that was to understand the following issues. So we had noted that Mechiras Chametz nowadays is considered to be somewhat controversial, somewhat well accepted also, and somewhat controversial, somewhere in the middle of controversial or not, and certainly less controversial today than Hetzer Mechira, but more controversial than, say, Prosbul. So on the controversial scale, it's somewhere in the middle. And I left you with a few questions that, on the one hand, it seems that the source in the Tosefta does give us a strong foundation for what we do, and yet there are others who question that maybe it's still not enough of a match, that maybe what we do nowadays is somewhat of a distance from what's described in the Tosefta, particularly because it sounds a little bit like it's a unplanned kind of urgent situation that just happens because of circumstances. Question about that?
So, I kind of want to re-ask my question with a little more context today, like after reading the Ritva.
Well, let's introduce it first. Let's give that some context. So, first, we noted two things about the Harama debate. We noted that, first of all, the word Harama could mean at least three things, and at least 100 different words, but at least three categories of things. Two of them bad, one of them neutral. So it could be that it's neutral in the sense that it just means avoiding a situation, but not necessarily in a judgmental way. It could be that it is bad, but two different types of bad. It could be that it's bad because it's not the spirit of the law, so basically it's an evasion of the real goal of whatever we're talking about. Or it could be probably worse than that, that it's fake and that it's dishonest. And that's the issue. And we noted that in the Mechiras Chametz, in the literature, you'll find basically four possibilities, that either it's not a harama, it's a harama, but that's okay, because haramas are neutral, it's a harama because it's fake, or it's a harama because it's an evasion. And then on top of all those four, there's still many permutations, because whether it is any one of those things or not probably is highly dependent on the details. So therefore, even within those four views, they probably shift very much, depending on the details of what we're talking about. So we noticed to frame this, so we noted that in terms of addressing it as a harama, so the conversation took place at least in two major arenas. More recently, the Bechor Shor, which you had a chance to see today, where the Bechor Shor seems to be asserting that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, and that he had three premises there. One, that it's a harama. Two, that haramas can only be used for dinim derabanan. And three, that it's okay because Mechiras Chametz is dealing with Rabbanans because Bittul knocks it down to that level. And we noted that all three are controversial, and hopefully today you have a little bit more backing to discuss that. But in terms of practice, we said there are basically four approaches to the Bechor Shor. Not necessarily that all four are aware of the Bechor Shor, but the basic gist of the Bechor Shor's three premises basically represent themselves in four views. There are those who will accept all three premises. There are those who reject all three premises, because each one is controversial in its own right. And there are those who split it, l'kula, and split it, l'chumra. So split it, l'chumra, would be to accept the first two, say that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, and there's something wrong with using that for a diman ha-Torah, but don't accept the last part, that bittul knocks it down to a drabanan. So what will that mean practically? It'll mean maybe that they will only use Mechiras Chametz for dinim derabanan, which is a somewhat prevalent view today. Or maybe there'll be some other shita that will be brought in to knock it down to derabanan, but not necessarily bittul. And then there's the split view lakula, which is to only focus on the last part and say that, yes, you do think bittul knocks it down to a drabanan, and that's a justification for a weak sale, for a sale that doesn't necessarily satisfy so much. And some of those who disagree with this focus on that point specifically and say that, no, you can't assume that mechira is relevant only to a drabanan here, that bittul knocks it down. It's two different sets of chametz. And if you're going to use the mechira, you have to be ready to acknowledge that you're dealing with deraisas, and no haramas can be permitted. It has to be completely serious. It has to be done with all the details. So that was one thing. And then we also noted that the Rishonim already addressed the question of harama. because they have a phrase, whether they brought it in or whether it was the Gers and the Tosefta isn't clear, but they all dealt with a phrase that you can do this mechira as long as it's not a harama. And as the Beis Yosef quoted from the Ben Yerucham, that seems difficult because it seems like it is a harama. So that seems like a strange sentence to say you can do this harama as long as it's not a harama. So what does it mean not to be a harama? And we noted that there are at least three ways to say it, and we haven't yet said what they are, so we'll try to get to that today as well. So before getting to the three ways, so let's go back to the Bechor Shur for a second. And let's try to identify the parts of what he says. So in terms of calling Mechiras Chametz harama, so we noted that not everyone agrees. So before you even get to the other two premises, not everyone sees it that way, and it's going to also depend on just reality and a little bit your attitude towards it, which makes it an unusual kind of machlokas. But among the prominent disputants of this position, there are many who disagreed, but perhaps the most well-known and consequential is the Chasam Sofer. So the Chasam Sofer in a number of tshuvas, he takes on this Bechor Shur basically from every level. The Bechor Shur, by the way, was very influential because of his own personal stature, but also he was the ancestor of a number of Mechaberim. So, for example, the Beis Ephraim was a grandson of his, and he writes extensively to defend his grandfather's position on this, and wrote actually an entire sefer to that end called Machnu Kinyan. So yes, there is a huge amount of literature on this topic, so just to see that one detail, that there's a number of entire sefarim. More recently, there was another sefer that was written in the contemporary era, also all just about defending the Tefillah Shur's position. So there's quite a lot written by people who independently agreed, maybe, but also have a family connection, have other connections with Tefillah Shur. And the Shari Tshuva on the Shulchan Aruch was also written by a relative. So there's a lot of reverence for and appreciation for the Tefillah Shur in general, and a lot of literature that was written about the subject as a whole, but a lot of it also specifically was defending the Bechor Shur. So his point about it being a harama, so that itself was addressed by the Chasam Sofer and also the Nesivos HaMishpat and the Sefer on Pesach, which is called Mekor Chaim. They both disagreed on this point. But what about the proof that he brings to this next position, that a harama is only acceptable if dealing with rabbinic law? So what do you think about that? Is he correct? Is that something that you can prove? Is that something that Chazal had established? Okay, so Eric and Caleb?
I think it goes kind of towards the lesser of the negative approaches to it, because if we're just trying to get past the spirit of the law, I guess they're wanting to kind of have that in their hand, like, and definitely kind of connected to the idea maybe that we have this Derabbanan Heter for if the woman is trying to refuse accepting the get, right? So when it comes to Derabbanan laws, Rabbanan could say, oh, the spirit that we tried to use is not working here, versus the Hashem, we don't understand all the deep complexities behind what he's saying. The Rabbanan are just not as complicated as the Raisa.
I'll put you on pause for a second. I think that there's something to be said about that, and we'll say a little bit more, but that's in terms of explaining what the position is about, and that's an important issue. But just as far as, is the position correct? Is it grounded in anything? Is there any basis for this? So, Caleb, then you did you?
Well, I remember that we studied, I forget who exactly says this, but I remember that we studied that had Shemitah been Doraita, even if Hillel could have been attacking the Pruz ball with Rava's Hefker, Beitin Hefker, he still wouldn't have done it because Shemitah would have been Doraita.
Okay, that's interesting. That could be a proof for this position that basically, let's say, the Tosfos in our Masechta. Tosfos, so it's actually a farther off proof than I was looking for, because I gave you a proof in today's Mar Makomos. But you are right that you're reaching back into past sugyas. So if you want to open your gittins for a second, that Tosfos on Daf Lamed Vav and Aleph. So there's a language here in Tosfos Dibur Maschol Mi. So you could say that this is maybe a proof for the Bechor Shor's position, that the language here reading from the middle of this Tosfos, Lamavav Min Aleph and Gittin, Mikol Makom Lo Hayolo, that's Hillel he's talking about, Lo Hayolo La Asos Takana, Lilameid La Asos Kain, Shebitel Bekach Hashmatas Ksafim Sheshiv Satoru. That if there was a deraisa status to Shemitah's Ksafim today, that even if Prizbal worked on its own or drew on mechanisms that already existed and could have been effective by level Min HaTorah, still, it's relevant that it would be Drabanan today because Hillel would not have made such an institution if this was something that was addressing a source Min HaTorah. So yes, Caleb, it's a good source. It's more than looking for because you have to reach back. What about today's Marmar Kamos, right? So is there a source in today's Marmar Kamos that addresses where the Bechor Shor come from? Yeah?
Gemara and Shabbos.
Okay, so tell me about the Gemara and Shabbos. And is that a good enough source or not?
Well, it seems to entertain the possibility that Harama would be good with Derabanan, but it seems to qualify that with only Tzorba and Derabanan.
Okay, so that's an important detail also. So that's a question that, with all the literature about this, very little addressed that detail, which is interesting. Now, on the surface, the Bechor Shor is coming from a Gemara and Shabbos, which you could say does state his position and refers specifically to allowing a Harama Bidrabana. So before addressing whether it matches or not, so Ezra's point is noteworthy that there is a condition there, that if we're gonna look to that, then we should impose more conditions, because why don't we say that it's only true for Tamidei Chachamim? And you never saw anyone who said that, really, that Mechiras Chametz is only allowed for Tamidei Chachamim. You did see those who say it should only be carried out by Talmidei Chachamim. That's a different point. But as far as only allowing it on behalf of Talmidei Chachamim, so that we never saw. So if we're going to look to this Gemara as relevant, so it's a pretty blatant question why that detail isn't addressed. It's addressed a little bit, but it's a small minority of the literature on this pays attention to that detail. So that's just a curiosity. How come that's not addressed so much? But the other part, so let's acknowledge that question, but what about setting that aside for a second? So does that Gemara prove the Bechor Shor's point? What do you think? Yes, no, we say, oh, there he is. He has the Farish Gemara, so end the story. Yeah?
Even though the words say Harama B'derabanan, the example it's dealing with there is very different.
Oh, excellent. Okay, so that goes to one of the major issues in this whole debate. Because a part of what makes it difficult is we don't even know if we're using terminology in the same way. So, yes, you do have a Gemara here saying something about Haramos, but we have to work harder to know if there's any relevance at all to Mechiras Chametz from that Gemara. So, yes, take it away, Ezra.
Because there you're dealing with Derabanans on Shabbos that are seemingly in place to prevent the Deoraisas.
Correct. Okay, so on the one hand, you're dealing with safeguards. And in those examples, what's going on? So are you kind of, is there any kind of sale going on to make something in a different category? It's not what's happening there. Right? So what's happening in these Gemaras? What the basic commonality in the situations?
You're circumventing the law.
You are circumventing it, but how? Basically by a fake out.
Right.
You're pretending to do something when you're really doing something else. So, one example, probably the most relatable one, is there's a gzeira midrabanan against going in a boat on Shabbos, and the Gemara talks about somebody who would take a nap on a raft and just say, okay, I'm just taking a nap, but really his intent is he's aware that the raft is going to float across the river. So he's actually doing that. He's actually taking a boat ride, a raft ride, across the river, but he's doing so under the pretense that he's taking a nap. And apparently, for Talmidei Chachamim, who they weren't concerned would violate the actual Isser D'Oraisa that is at the core, so there was a certain leniency to allow for that. But only because we're dealing with a safeguard Midrabanan, and we wouldn't allow one to violate an Isser D'Oraisa under those circumstances. However, as Ezra's indicating, But is that what's going on here? So Rav Shechter Shlita and Rav Asher Weiss Shlita and their respective Svarim and Bikve Hatzon and Minchas Asher, they both argue on the Bechor Shor because they say his proof is just a completely different discussion. It uses that word harama, but we don't know if it's been applied yet to Mechiras Chametz. So there, the examples are somebody misrepresenting what he's doing. But to avoid a situation by creating a different kind of category, so why should we think that that is relevant to that Gemara and Shabbos? So that already is a major debate about that second premise of the Bechor Shor. His reliance on this Gemara and Shabbos, some will argue that it's simply apples and oranges. It's a whole different story. And just because the word harama is used, so yes, in the case of Mechiras Chametz, we are escaping the halachic regulation by categorizing it differently, by doing something that changes its status. But what does that got to do with the examples of the Gemara in Shabbos? Now, in defense of the Bechor Shor, what we're seeing here again is that the terminology is just being used differently. Because the Bechor Shor's issue with Mechiras Chametz is probably not that you are avoiding the spirit of the law, but that he does think that this is essentially comparable to a guy lying down in a raft and pretending he's going to sleep when he is actually sailing across. Why? Because he thinks the whole sail is a sham. And therefore, it's claiming to be doing one thing while really doing another thing. So that is a part of what drives this machlokes. It's a fundamentally different understanding of what's going on. So because he sees the sail as so deficient, it's not that he's bothered by your escaping your obligation. He's bothered by his assumption that it doesn't even work. And if it doesn't work, it means you're claiming something and you're really doing something else. So in his mind, it basically is the same as what the Gemara and Shabbos is talking about. And that's only acceptable because you're dealing with Yisurim D'Rabbanan. So that's a pretty fundamental difference of understanding in what's going on. And also in terms of what the conclusion would be. Everyone following so far? So now to turn to Eric's point for a second. Kev, you had a question about that? Or you had a...
Well, I was going to ask. So the Gemara and Shabbat proves that it's okay for Talmid Chacham to be over a Gzeira D'Rabbanan if they're not being over on the D'Oraita that the D'Rabbanan is protecting?
There were certain situations where Chazal allowed for that. We don't know if it applies to examples beyond these cases, but there were certain situations where Chazal made a Din D'Rabbanan and only targeted it towards situations where they were worried about it being violated. So a Talmid Chacham who knew what the boundaries were, so they weren't worried about that, but it had to be that it wasn't going to be misleading to people, because if it was something that couldn't be allowed for the populace as a whole, so therefore it's only allowed when it's being basically hidden behind something else. So that's where you come to this conclusion that a harama in a drabbanan is acceptable, but only in those cases, presumably, and only for a Talmid Chachamim, which again seems to be a pretty big difference between that and how it's being applied here. But on the fundamental question of aren't these cases very different than the Mechiras Chametz? So yes, but the Bechor Shor's point was that he thought they weren't different. And he thought that it's all about misrepresenting what you are doing. So now, Eric, I want to bring in your point from before. So setting aside the question of whether the riot is good or not, but why is it true? If it's true, if there is a distinction between rabbinic law and Torah law here, so why would there be a distinction? Now, many don't think there is a distinction. Many do. There's probably a big list of poskim on both sides. But why would it be that there is basis to distinguish between Torah law and rabbinic law? So we could explain it a number of ways, probably at least three or four ways. And one of them will come back to what Eric said before. So one, don't necessarily love this, but it could be that we're just more worried about Torah law than we are about rabbinic law. So maybe when it comes to Torah law, we're not willing to play any games. But when it comes to rabbinic law, so we're less worried about it, so we're more open to playing games, essentially. So personally, I wouldn't love that approach, because first of all, it also makes it sound like we're playing games. And also, we are supposed to have reverence for rabbinic law. So the notion that, well, we don't have to take it seriously because it's din d'rabbanan, that's generally not a healthy attitude for rabbinic, Talmudic, Orthodox Jews. So we generally do have reverence for rabbinic law as well. Now, it's true that we say Suffolk, d'rabbanan, l'kula, but there's a whole history behind that and a whole svara behind that. And we wouldn't necessarily want to formulate it as, yeah, Suffolk, d'rabbanan, l'kula, because, yeah, you know, it's just a d'rabbanan, so we're chill. So presumably that's not the terrific explanation, but that might be one that comes to mind first. Eric?
So it's not like, I don't think it's about like disrespecting their d'rabbanan laws. I think it's more about, in a sense, also we have like Shos HaShvus, where like, we when it comes to Hashem and Hashem's knowledge of the world and the future and everything, like, Hashem did, when Hashem said the law, like, he meant it. Like, there was nothing else besides it. When they're about to make a law, they're, as amazing as they were, their knowledge is just limited. And, you know, we even have Gemaras where we find that their abundant didn't even have the correct science at the time, and we still hold by the laws, but clearly there's still a lack in their knowledge in terms of everything. So we see that in a clear sense. So it's that, I mean, just the fact that when Hashem makes a law, Hashem knows forever and ever what's going on. Their abundant just don't have the extent of the knowledge to know everything at all, everything everywhere all at once. But
so I'm going to formulate that very differently, because he started off going where I was going to go, but then he went in a very different direction. So let me formulate it very differently.
Right.
I certainly would not say that we're taking a kula approach because we don't think the Rabbana knew enough, or that there's a mistake here. That would not be something that we could either say or incorporate into a halachic attitude. But formulate it differently, cut off like the second half of the sentence, go to the first half of the sentence. So what it could mean is that there is a fundamental difference in a different way. And this is a position that's associated with the Nesivos HaMishpat. We mentioned him a minute ago, but this is from a different comment of the Nesivos HaMishpat. So there is a general attitude, I'm sure we've mentioned it before, that there is a fundamental structural difference between Torah law and rabbinic law. And it may connect to the idea that rabbinic laws are safeguards, largely, not 100%, but many of them are safeguards for Torah law. And maybe what it could reflect, there's actually a number of ways of getting to this conclusion, but just to say it in a brief way, that it could be that Torah law is inherent. So if the Torah says, don't eat chazer, there's something inherently spiritually damaging about chazer. But rabbinic laws very often are safeguards. So they don't claim to be representing anything inherent. And there might be other ways to come to this conclusion, but let's just say it that way. So when they say, don't eat chicken cheeseburgers, so they're not claiming there's anything inherently bad about chicken cheeseburgers, but that it could lead you to eating beef cheeseburgers, which is the Esser D'oraisa. So therefore, it's already structurally different in terms of what we're talking about. And together with that, there are those who formulated the nature of the obligation to listen to Dinan D'Rabbanan, which according to the Rambam is rooted in Parsha Shoftim with the language of Lo Sasser Min HaDavar Asher Yagidu Lecha, that one should not deviate, that one should not rebel against the words of Chazal. So if that's the case, so then essentially what we're saying here is that the Gedr HaIsser is about compliance, or lack of compliance. So if we're worried that we're deviating from the spirit of the law, so it might be reasonable to say that the spirit of the law really only exists with Dinim and HaTorah. that there's something that's prohibited for some reason, whether we understand the reason or not. So the prohibition is the letter of the law, and the reason is the spirit. But when it comes to dinim derabanan, they might be formulated as all about compliance, about not rebelling against the authority of Chazal. So it could be that the spirit of the law in rabbinic law is following the rules. So as long as you're following the rules, you are in compliance with the spirit of the law. So maybe if that's what we're worried about, maybe there's a basis to say that on those grounds, maybe there's a distinction between Torah law and rabbinic law. So not that we don't care about rabbinic law, God forbid, but that all rabbinic law asks of us is compliance. And as long as you're complying, there isn't something beyond that to worry about. So far, so good. So that could be an explanation. I don't think it's what the Before Shore is saying, but being that many of the positions here sometimes got removed from their original source literature, it's possible that that was one way to explain it. Alternatively, and I think Eric was saying this before also, earlier, is the way the Chassam Sofer understood it, that maybe this is itself a function of rabbinic law. That maybe haramos, really, we can't say that they are prohibited. That we can't say that they neutralize the din. So if we leave it alone, haramos exist. And any prohibition to use them, we don't find that in the Chumash itself, presumably, unless maybe you look very hard and you have a suggestion. But we don't find an explicit iser in the Torah of haramos. So probably, if there is some problem in using them, so then that is a din d'rabbanan. And maybe then Chazal prohibited using haramos when Torah law is involved. But they didn't make the prohibition regarding their own law. So that's one of maybe many distinctions that you find in terms of how Chazal regulated things. So maybe that's the reason. So they made a rule, the whole issue with haramos is itself rabbinic. And that being the case, so the rabbis only applied it to Torah law and not to rabbinic law. So far, so good? So those are possible, but what really sounds most likely from the Bechor Shor's perspective is that if you share all his premises, then it's really much more fundamental than that. And that really what's going on, in the case of the Gemara and Shabbos, the issue is that you're actually violating the Issur. And Chazal just allowed it in certain cases because they weren't worried about the next step. So if that's what's going on, so then for sure we could see the distinction. Because if we're saying that a harama means you're actually doing the prohibited thing and pretending it's something else, so then for sure we can't allow that on a level minat Torah. Why would we ever think that that could be allowed on a level minat Torah? And the only reason the Gemara and Shabbos was allowing it at all is because that was part of the rules of those dinim drabanan, that those halachos allowed for violating them under certain conditions, because it wasn't a concern that it would lead to the Isser Minat Torah. So if that's really what's going on, you're violating the Isser but pretending it's something else, so then for sure it wouldn't be allowed on a level Minat Torah. And it's surprising that it's ever allowed even on a level Midrabanan, as Caleb said before. So that's because Chazal made certain dispensations under certain circumstances. But there certainly wouldn't be a license to do it on a level Minhag Torah. Everybody with me?
Can you repeat that last point?
The last one is, like, if you really think about it, if the Gemara that the Bechor Shor is using is really the source here, so then for sure, and if that's really relevant to Mechiras Chametz, so then for sure you couldn't allow that by a Daraisa, because what's going on in those Gemaras is that you're essentially violating the Isser at hand and pretending it's something else. So it was a chiddush that that should be allowed for anything. The point was that the Chazal allowed it under certain circumstances with their own prohibitions when they weren't afraid it would lead to an actual Torah violation, which is part of why it's conditioned specifically on Serva Mirabana. So if that's what's going on, then for sure you couldn't have that kind of approach to an Issur D'oraisa, because you're actually violating the Issur. Who's letting you violate the Issur? Why is it better because you're pretending you're doing something else? So all of that will lead to a pretty severe understanding from the Bechor Shor's perspective of what's going on with Mechiras Chametz. That essentially what he's describing here is that you are really violating the Issur because the sale is nothing, so you continue to own Chametz on Pesach. And therefore, that's the problem. So it's that you are simply, it's that we don't have to really say that, well, it's haram, we don't allow it. What he really means is that it's nothing, it's a sham sale. And if it's a sham sale, so then you are just violating the Issur Min HaTorah and calling it something else. So it's a pretty extreme view that the Bechor Shor is putting forward here. Right? Now, we may find in a few minutes that even the Bechor Shor maybe didn't have such an extreme position. But let's just hold on to that for a second. That's essentially what the Bechor Shor seems to be saying. So, that in mind, let's now go to the Rishonim. And we're not going to be able to finish all this today, but let's see how far we can get. So, as far as the Rishonim, what are the possible suggestions as to what it means when you have this condition, it can't be a harama? I noted there are at least three that you could find in the Rishonim. So somebody help me out. What are some of the suggestions as to what this condition means? You can do this harama as long as it's not a harama, meaning as long as what? Somebody help me out. Yes, Ezra?
Ritva said you can't do it like every year.
Okay, so the Ritva's position that you can't do it every year, that's the one that would seem to be the worst for us, right? Because if that's really a rule, then we're in trouble. Right? So if those are the only sources we have, so then, yes, we can understand the whole objection to today's Mechiras Chametz, despite the Tosefta, because the Ritva, if we, that's the only source, so then comes out like this, to say it all in one sentence. The Tosefta is saying, yes, you can transfer Chametz to somebody else over the course of Pesach, as long as you don't do it every year. And we do it every year, there you go. That explains the whole controversy. Now, it happens to be that the Ritva is actually not brought lahalacha at all. So as far as the tradition of Pesach, so we don't necessarily have to worry that that actually gets us in trouble. But let's try to understand it for a second. So why would it be, let's say if this really is a position, that you can't do it every year, so why should that be? Caleb?
Well, from what we've seen, it really seems like this is a Sha'at Hadachak thing. And it's like, okay, I'll do it if I really have to, but the fact that one starts to do it every year makes it seem like this is the norm, this is what we do. We give our chametz away, but then we take it back. So did we really give it away to begin with?
All right, so that certainly seems like one position. Let's flesh that out in a second and see what you're just going to say.
I just say that then lechatchila you won't take it seriously. You won't put more preparation into the antiv, and you just won't take it seriously because
so
then
it's
you
kind
have,
of a,
it's a fallback, so you're going to do that every year, and then
okay,
you're
so
more accustomed to it because you do it every year, but once in a while if something comes up, then you can do it, but if not, it becomes a custom, and then you just don't prepare or don't put seriousness into it.
Okay, so that's similar, so but there's actually more to say about that, but unfortunately we don't have endless hours because there's so much more here we could explore. That will give you maybe a source for tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to do Chumash and Shabbos Hagadol, but we're going to so we have Zooming on Sunday and Monday, or just Sunday we can be in person and Zoom on Monday.
I think Monday is the official Zoom day, but I know Sunday gets
college also, or just
Monday it's college day.
College,
well, everything is
Zoom, but there is college classes, but they're on Zoom.
That's what it says.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right.
Yeah,
so
I stayed at Dumber every day.
So, lucky man. So, there's still a lot more to say about this, so we'll have to spill over a little bit, but. So let's just explore this. Let's at least try to get this part done today. So what Caleb and Yadidja expressed is that maybe it's just not right, that this was not meant to be done regularly. And this is perhaps reflecting the idea that if you're saying it's a harama if you do it all the time, maybe what we mean is, how are we defining harama in this case? Let's say between our two choices of evasion or fakery, so which translation is relevant to this explanation?
Evasion. And the Ritva definitely seems to say it's fake. It's Kiyulah, can't do it at all.
So I think you might be right, but then I think that's going to take us in a different direction. So hold off on that for a second. So without knowing the language of the Ritva, because you might be right, hold over a second, yeah?
I was going to say, based off, not the language, but how the formulation would seem like evasion.
Okay, so I think you're right also. So I think that essentially, if you understand it the way Caleb and Yedidja were formulating it, then what's bothering us is that it is evasive. That really, it's not in the spirit of the law. That what the Torah wanted was you're actually going to destroy your chametz. But if you get stuck and your whole parnassah depends on it, maybe that's the premise here. The guy is traveling with his wares because it's his livelihood. And he wasn't able to plan properly because he got stuck on a boat. So then, all right, it's an emergency, but really it's not right. So therefore, if that's the case, so then for you to take advantage of this all the time, so then you are evading the din long term. And then that's wrong. It's basically morally wrong. And that all reflects an understanding of Harama that it's about not being consistent with the spirit of the law. That essentially it's an evasion of what you're really supposed to do. So just to reflect that, for example, with Nassan Gishtetner and his Chuvis Lahoris Nassan, so he quotes as a principle based on the Ritva that you can't do haramos regularly. You can only do them occasionally. So that's an interesting extrapolation, because for that to be true, I think you have to be understanding the Ritva that way, and therefore say that it's not only about Mechiras Chametz, it's about anything like this. Anything like this that is not really in the spirit of the law. So sometimes under emergency situations, you can utilize them, but it's not right to do it as a standard normal operating procedure, because that is avoiding spirit of the law. So that's all one understanding. As Eric correctly points out, though, that it seems like it's more fundamental than that. Why?
So he talks about the idea that, like, essentially what you did, Kiilu, you literally just let him, like, not, like, hold it in his rishus for about 7 or 8 days, Israel, 7 or 8 days, and then just took it back. Like, he just held on to it for you, almost like you went away for the weekend and you left your dog somewhere, so someone's house for the weekend. So
true, but there's also one phrase there that really indicates that it's something more. You're right. This is a little more. One phrase there, one halachic psak that he ruled.
Oh, he says the chametz is usher to you.
Exactly right. So it sounds like he's saying more than it's just not right. And he's saying that it actually doesn't work. That the chametz remains prohibited.
Well, I almost feel like he's not saying the sale itself doesn't work, because then he might say that it's usher to do it. He doesn't even say you're not allowed to do it. He just says that afterwards it's us or low. So the chametz is us or you. So I feel like he's almost saying the sale works because you're never going to use the chametz again, essentially. But if you use the chametz again, then it would
be... Well, that part I think is hard. I think you were right before. I think what he's saying is that the chametz remains prohibited because it didn't go through, because the sale is no good. So it sounds really like, despite the plausibility of what was just said a few minutes ago and the Lahoris Nassim's understanding of it, but based on his actual language, I think the Ritva is saying something else, that he's not coming from the position that Harama is translated as evasion, but rather it's translated here as fakery, that basically it's not effective. So therefore, the sale doesn't have any impact. Now, why should it become ineffective, just because it's done repeatedly? It works once, but it doesn't work many times. What does that mean? So like you said before, that the purchaser perhaps is going to be a little suspicious. You're generally using the same purchaser every year, and he's going to realize that you always come back for it after Pesach. So he's going to think that you're not really selling it. And maybe even more so, like Eric was mentioning, maybe he has to guard it for you because there's always the expectation that it's coming back after Pesach. So maybe that means he doesn't actually intend to buy it from you. He doesn't believe there's any sale happening. So it's more of a fundamental problem. It goes to the actual viability of the sale. Yeah?
I kind of took it, more towards the second half of what Rabbi's saying, is that when it becomes habitual, like, and you know it's going to happen, like, it take, like, it before it could have been a sale. Maybe he actually would have taken it this year. Maybe he actually would have wanted to keep the chametz this year. But if he does it every year, there's not even like a chashash that he's ever going to take it again. So I feel like the reason Makir's chametz is supposed to work is because there's the reality that they could actually eat the chametz and use to do whatever they want with it. But if there's really no chance they're going to, it becomes habitual. There's no shot that they're ever going to use it before you buy it back. Then it's not really a sale. Like it's all a show.
All right, that is an important point, but I don't know if we need that much. I think what we said so far already probably explains it. Now, that being said, having said that we don't seem to accept this restriction in the halacha, but what maybe might indicate that it was a correct restriction from the sources? What may give you reason to think that, yeah, I see where the ritual is coming from, but it can't be done every year, based on the text? Any proof you can bring to support that? Well, what about the fact that the scenario that teaches us this din, right? What about that scenario maybe makes it sound like it's not, yeah?
The fact that they're on a boat.
The fact that they're on a boat, right? Why does the Tosefta describe it this way? Why doesn't the Tosefta just say that if you want to separate from your chametz and reunite after Pesach, so here's what you do. Transfer it to your next door neighbor and come back and get it from him after Pesach. So the fact that it sounds like you're describing intentionally a situation of a guy stuck on a boat, why teach it that way if not to say that it's only in that kind of a circumstance that it is permitted? Caleb?
It's interesting, although the Mishnah itself says that one may sell it.
Right. But there, we're talking about selling it forever. So that we understand. So here you
right. Talk. So it seems as though as long as the forever, the, you know, you can always buy something back, and well, not always, but in real life, you can, in theory, buy things back.
Right,
but as long as the intention is that you're selling it forever, that's what counts. And that, okay, you buy it back 8 days later, you buy it back 8 days later.
So you're asking how is it different, you're saying?
I'm saying that, you know, that it's not just, oh, you're on a boat, so you sell it to, or give it to a non-Jew.
Your point might be true in and of itself, right? And that may also be the answer, practically speaking. And you don't have to be bothered by the fact that there is a repurchase afterwards. But that's a separate discussion. It could be true in and of itself. But what we're noting here is that if this was something that was just an option all the time, so why describe it as somebody stuck on a boat? Why don't we just say that you want to get rid of it, you want to reconnect with your chametz after Pesach while still not having it on Pesach? Here's the etzah. Transfer it to your non-Jewish neighbor and reacquire it after Pesach. Why not just say it like that? Eric?
Well, maybe it's going the opposite way. Maybe the idea is that when you're on a boat, like, it's like not really such like closed quarters as like houses, like you could very easily see it and take it back. And then they can't even run away with it. They're still on the boat with you, so you have even a bigger chance of getting it back. So when it comes to some town, maybe they run away with the chametz, maybe they lock it on their house, there's even less chance that you can reacquaint yourself with their chametz.
All right, that's interesting. So let's formulate that also a different way. I'm taking half of your sentences today.
Yeah, we'll chat this time.
Right, so hold on to that for 1 second, and we'll come back and I'll co-opt half of the sentence. So one way to answer the question of, or to respond when we say that, why don't we just formulate this as, here's what you do and leave that below. So if you saw the Shulchan Aruch, that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. And the Shulchan Aruch, when it paskins this, does not bring the boat scenario. So therefore, in Achanami, for practice, it's a question why the Tosefta formulated that way. But in practice, the din's not brought down to us that way, and we're not forced to see it as only in exigent circumstances. However, the Rambam does. The Rambam does bring the boat story, even though there's no other indication from the Rambam that this is something that is limited to those circumstances. So why is that? So here's where I'm taking half of Eric's sentence, that there are some who suggest that maybe the boat is there because it's a chiddush lekula. Maybe the detail is significant, not to restrict, but actually to make it broader and to show you that even in these circumstances, it works. So why is that? So Eric suggested one way, but maybe another way. So some Svarim suggest, and there's already a hint to this in the Nosa Kalim in the Rambam, that maybe the impact of the boat is to paint the picture this way. That clearly, this was not this owner's intent. The owner was not looking to sell it to the guy traveling on the boat with him. How do we know that? Because why is he on the boat with his chametz in the first place? So presumably he is a merchant who is traveling to some far-off location where he was going to sell the chametz there. If he wanted to sell the chametz to the guy next to him, he didn't have to travel anywhere in the first place. He could have done that a long time ago. So the fact that he has chametz with him on a boat, it's probably showing us that this is not his plan. His plan was not just to sell it to anyone, but specifically to go somewhere far away, maybe he gets a good rate for it there, and to sell it there. So the fact that he's selling it to the guy next to him, which he could have done all along, we see that that's clearly not his intent. He's only doing that because of Pesach. And maybe the chiddush is that, yes, even with that fact set, it's still okay. So maybe the boat scenario is actually a chiddush l'kula to tell us that even with that proof that it's not his intent, it's still acceptable. Hi.
That's assuming the Jew on the boat is going to sell for the sake of buying after Pesach? Or for
not necessarily, but the point is that he clearly changed path because he was going to sell this elsewhere. And now, because of Pesach, he changed his plans in a way that he clearly wasn't trying to do.
Why is that helpful?
Because you might think that, okay, he's selling it, so then, you know, similar to what Caleb was saying before, that, oh, if he's really selling it, so then he's always allowed to do that. So what's the difference between this and a normal sale? So, oh, the difference is because this is clearly not the sale he was trying to do. And you could say that, yes, anybody who has chametz and sells it to a non-Jew for good on Erev Pesach is okay. But here, it's not really what's happening, because when he was going to sell it, it was on the market in a faraway location. The fact that he sold it to this guy, so maybe that you would have thought is not okay or is not going to be credible. And maybe the chiddush is that, yes. Okay, so Sam, and then you did it up at more points. We have to have a minute.
The reason why, look, like the chiddush is that it's because it's a Pesach sale.
Yeah, or
it's not a for profit. It's for,
right,
and it's for because of halachot that are now applying. Now he's selling
people. Different from what he intended to do.
But maybe they're not separable. But is it intention or like the it's a different. It's not just intention, but it's a different kind of sale.
So it may not matter in the end because it's basically about a half a minute and a maskana. But we'll see if there are other details that point us in that direction. Did you?
Why would I think that it wouldn't work because he intended to sell it elsewhere?
Because the sale becomes maybe, and again, it's a half a minute, so it's hard to put too much emphasis on why it would have been true, but this is perhaps going to look like a fake sale because it's something that he could have done at any time and chose not to. So it doesn't look like it's really his normal type of selling,
right. Perhaps.
So just make one more observation, then we'll have to dive in, and then so we'll find time in the next few days to go through the other interpretations. But what about the following point, though? So even if we do take the case in the Mishnah to be particularly relevant, as some point out, you know, part of the objection that later Sfarim had, later Machabrim had to today's Mechiras Chametz, is the assumption that this was driven by need, by great Parnassa considerations, especially as Jews got more involved in the liquor industry. So it was really motivated by that. And people today who don't necessarily have that concern, some do, but the average Balabas doesn't. So in that situation, so maybe it isn't justifiable. But even if that's your position, that doesn't lead you to saying it can't be every year. Because the people who are affected by this financially maybe are affected every year. If you're in the liquor business or you're in some other kind of business that is tied into chametz, so you may every year have a problem with destroying your whole inventory, and there's nothing that's going to call that into question just because you do it regularly. So maybe it's more understandable if we were to make a limitation based on how necessary it is for the individual. But to say that that translates into you can't do it every year, that doesn't necessarily follow from that. And that's also perhaps another reason why, even if we do focus on the example specifically, it doesn't lead us necessarily to the conclusion that it can't be done every year. So one way or another, it doesn't seem that the Ritva's position has been accepted lahalacha, although we saw some interesting ways to examine as to what he was talking about and what did that reflect about the issue at hand. But in practice, it doesn't seem like that is psak, so we don't have to worry about that. But we do have to worry about something, because there is some condition here that tells us we have to watch out for this, so it shouldn't be a harama. So what are that condition? So at least two other possibilities. We'll have to, God willing, get that in sometime soon. Okay, who is going to volunteer to... That was for us. Do you have any...